right, welcome back to the North Star Method podcast, where we give you the mental skills to be at your best when it matters most. My name is Sebastian. I am the co-founder and CEO of North Star Performance Psychology.
And I'm Sean, co-founder and director of Max Performance. And before we get into today, I don't know, as the video watchers can see, I am repping the University of Florida. I wanted to shout out the boys down in Gainesville for taking home the national championship, their third basketball. They're now the only school, I believe, in the SEC or in college that has three football and basketball natties. So pretty impressive. We're one with like UNC, Duke, and I think UConn that has three plus championships. So they joined elite company. Congrats, hard fought win to the end. Hell of a season, hell of a tournament. So yeah, just wanted to do that real quick. Sorry.
I mean, it was overdue for them. Also, shout out Elijah Martin, former FAU player.
Yeah,
to the Final Four with them. Great comeback. And that's what we love to see in sports. You know, no shortage of mindset. Went into staying in it, especially against a physical team like Houston.
For sure.
Speaking of teams, today's episode, we're diving into the mailbag. Everybody on the North Star team, whether they're athletes, artists, founders, our clients have a priority to send in questions to get answered on the podcast. If you're interested in getting on the list so that your questions can get answered, head over to northstarknows.com and see if there's a way for yourself to get involved. Sign your deal with North Star. We're always looking to work with good people. With that being said, question number one.
Oh, Miria. I'll ask the first one.
All right.
So, what I wanted to start with, kind of a just general warm-up question. What is the difference between mental toughness and emotional suppression? It's kind of like a mental toughness can be misconceived a lot of times in terms of just pushing emotions down. Whereas I would argue there's a different definition, but curious to hear what's on your mind.
Yeah, so if you are a high achiever, you need to hear this. The reality is that we live in a culture that is obsessed with performance. And so the expectations that you've internalized for the amount of productivity that you need to put out are beyond what is actually realistic. And you might be hearing that and saying to yourself, well, I can work 24/7. You know, that's what I do. And that's what got me to where I am. But one thing that we like to talk about a lot is that what got you here won't get you there. Elite athletes, artists, entrepreneurs alike are all realizing how big of a role recovery plays in their performance. And so we want people to understand that mental toughness is just as much about using discipline to get the rest that you need as it is to push yourself to do the hard things. And as a matter of fact, like we talked about a couple episodes ago, most disciplined people don't need help doing more work. And so they have to find ways to put boundaries on when they stop and look at their rest as something that is part of their performance. I guess a segue that I'll add, because I wonder if you have anything to talk about with regard to this, is like the rebound effect. So the idea that when you push emotions down, this is energy, right? So you can't destroy it, can't go anywhere. If you push it, it bounces back at you stronger. This is why you see if you have a small problem in your life, you'll notice that it circles around in a bigger way until you address it. Usually there's some kind of emotional energy around that.
Yeah, I definitely believe in the rebound effect. In terms of mental toughness versus suppression, I think the mentally tough thing to do would be to see what's disrupting optimal performance. And is that overtraining? And can you be tough enough to accept that maybe you're not doing 100% of things right? I would say from a zoomed out perspective, most of us aren't doing 100% of things right. And people who are high achievers, people who are highly confident, they have a hard time accepting this and facing in the things that might be kind of holding them back. So they like to suppress it, forget about it, put it to the side, put it on the back burner. And what that does is just like doesn't make for a good internal environment. Like your hormones are out of whack and you really have this thing in the back of your head. You can't completely forget about it. And like you said, energy cannot be created nor destroyed. It can only be put somewhere. And the more you stuff down and then try to like force the lid on top of these feelings, the more they do kind of spill out of a higher rate. So what would be more mentally tough is learning how to influence your thoughts influencer feelings and influencer actions in the way that is most helpful and doesn't disrupt this consistent level of high core.
So what do you say about a guy like Michael Jordan, Tom Brady, Bill Belichick, these guys that are sort of the pinnacle of high performance, at least in yesterday's world of sports? They seem to push a lot of things down, have consequences in their personal life. Is that mental toughness, or is there a new way?
It's hard to speak on people who I don't know all of their habits, but I like to think of Kobe as another one of these guys. Obviously, Mamba mentality, kind of like the cornerstone of this like personification of your ideal performance mindset. You think of Kobe on the court, and even Kobe at like press conferences, is very ruthless, very just stoic, focused, job's not done. You know, I can't celebrate being up 2-0 until we win this game. I would argue that that doesn't dominate his whole life. He just knows that this is the mindset he needs to get into when it's performance time, when it's basketball time. You see him, I mean, rest in peace before he passed with his daughters, and like as a member of the community, he's a good guy, good enough guy for what we know, and like a good father. Certainly some character issues that may or may not be accurate, I'm not sure, but I think that the people who can compartmentalize these emotions have a good, I guess this is mental toughness in a way. Can you be ruthless and forget about it during the game, during the performance? But I'm sure they come back to it. I'm sure they have a reflection that they're like, okay, what went well there? What's worth improving? And what can I do to like sort of implement? Because whether this is mental or physical, maybe I was burnt out a lot after such a stressful performance. Maybe I need to take a look at actually mentally recovering. Long answer, I guess, to a short question, but being able to compartmentalize a shift into the mindset that is most helpful at that time, I guess, would be how I think of these guys.
Maybe the best embodiment of mental toughness that I've heard in a quote came from World Surf League championship poor surfer Joao Chianca, and he described it as, if you want to be a world champion surfer, you have to have warm blood and a cold heart. And I think about that a lot because obviously it's actually the other way around. You have to be warm-hearted and cold-blooded.
And now that makes more sense.
Yeah, it's obviously warm heart, right? It's the way you interact with people. It's the way you carry yourself. You're inviting, you're generous. But when it comes time to go for the kill, you can turn that on. And Jordan Peterson talks about it as well. This idea that you're job, especially as a leader, is not to be docile and gentle all of the time. You want to have that killer within you, but only bring it out at the right times. And we've had experience with MMA fighters, even UFC fighters, who are some of the most gentle people that you'll ever meet, right? They're really kind, they're really warm, and that all rests on the fact that if it came down to it, they could probably take anybody in the room. So they don't have to show that all.
They're fully secure on their selves. Like, this guy's not going to be my ass.
Exactly. Yeah. So that's another aspect of mental toughness, is not just feeling all your emotions and using them instead of pushing them down. It's also resting in the fact that if it came down to it, you know that you can win no matter what. So you don't have to brag. You don't have to show it off. It's not always this mode of like proving yourself. So is it good to have a chip on your shoulder? Yes. But is it good to talk about it all the time? No. That shows insecurity. And we've seen people, you know, get drafted and say, everybody before me was a mistake, right? And then be a complete bust. What's the difference between that and say a guy like Baker Mayfield, right?
Or Amon Ra has got Amos 1%.
Great example.
Yeah. Like, I have a list of everybody drafted before me. And it can serve as motivation. I mean, Amon Ra, St. Brown, he has a podcast as well, forgetting the name of it, with his brother, Aquanimius. And these guys are like Mr. Universe. I think your dad was Mr. Universe. They were born, I think, in Germany. They can speak like four languages. Like, this guy is not a, like, I mean, to my knowledge, he doesn't seem like a killer instant guy, but he can use it and, again, kind of compartmentalize it as motivation. He's a fourth-round draft pick. He was a draft pick with like Jalen Waddle, who, I mean, shout out Waddle, the Dolphins. I love Jalen Waddle, but there was probably a lot of series he should have been picked for. And he's never been rude to Ja'Marr Chase or Jalen Waddle or Devontae Smith, all of which were picked before him in that draft. But he knows where he should have been. And the Lions were generous enough, I guess, to give him a chance and to form a name battle zone three times too. But, you know, whatever works to get you there. And as long as you can kind of not just be in this I hate everybody mindset.
There was a little bit of a debate earlier in this past NFL season where Baker had made a comment talking about how the environment in the Buccaneers locker room had kind of become a lighter, more fun environment when he stepped in. Obviously, huge shoes to fill following the GOAT. And I remember Brady kind of responding to that, saying, well, look, you know, this is not Disneyland. If you want to have fun, that's where you go. This is where we come to do our job, and that's where we win championships. And obviously, Brady's resume speaks for itself. There is also this argument that maybe things have shifted. Could Brady still do what he did and Belichick run the culture that he had today? We talk about cultures of extraction versus unlocking. So cultures where you look at your players as an asset that you need to mine and you need to get value out of versus looking at them as sort of like capital that you need to invest in. And it does seem like in this next generation, people are a lot more interested in being supported as a human versus following orders. Is there some space for those more authoritarian type regimes, or is there a new culture that we need to adapt to?
I think there is space for it. And I think we kind of agree on this, like the direction of kind of mindset, you could argue is getting a little soft, and for a good reason, potentially. Like, we don't want to hurt people's feelings because that puts them into more of a fight or flight mode because they want to escape the situation and they're not able to think clearly. But having a safe space 100% of the time is not conducive to growth and not conducive to, like, a lot of times high achievement. And in my opinion, a good leader is somebody who can garner the respect of the team and be able to say the hard things that no one else wants to say when the owners meet to hear. And it's a balancing act. And I know I've said this before, like, it cannot be a simple answer, but a leadership skill in that sense is understanding how to best communicate to your team, knowing the individual communication styles. How does this person react when I say something in this delivery, in this tone? And knowing how to, like, make these adjustments while still keeping your eye on the prize and working hard toward it. While everybody feels like they're still, like, valued and, you know, valid.
Yeah. I think you said it best. Like, it's kind of a yin and yang, and you kind of have to earn the right to give orders. And so Belichick earned that through results, right?
Yeah.
Like, they won championships, so you come here and you do the Patriot way. Now, I think people are a lot less interested in external results because they know how possible it is. And they're a lot more interested in, like, how do I feel when I'm here? And what you've said, there's been this overcorrection in the psychology space where things are too soft. It's all about comfort zone, safe space. And that completely prevents you from putting yourself in situations where you can push yourself and you can grow. And so when it comes down to Baker or Brady's approach, there is no right or wrong answer. It does come down to the context. And you have to be flexible enough to change your approach based on the people that you're dealing with or based on your goals. You can't have a fixedness in your mindset about this is the only way, because that's how you end up basically getting outdated.
Yep.
One example that I'm aware of a culture that did a really good job of this kind of new age making people feel valued is the Giants, who obviously have struggled in a bit of recent seasons. But they did have a year where they were not expected to perform well at all. I believe it was Dable's first year.
His first or second. That's the year they went to the playoffs and beat the Vikings.
Yes.
Yeah.
And in that year, they were so injured. I don't even think Shepard was playing Slate, and they were throwing the guys off the practice squad and they were balling out. And you could say that, you know, people didn't have them figured out, but when you go through 18 games, like, people watch film. So if you're winning in December, you're doing something right. Team psychologist Monty Orenz, an alumni of the University of Denver, came and spoke to us, and she talked about the culture that really emphasized even role players and bench players, like, you're part of this team. And so how many times have you been in a position where you felt like you were competing with your team and you had different goals than that?
Mm.
The truth is, on an NFL roster, right?
Yeah.
as much as people tell you that, you know, we love you and we want you here, if you go down, someone can take your job.
You're also always like playing for your job. Like you're on an expiring contract. And, you know, if you want to go to another team, your motivations might not be the same as some second year rookie who, you know, is trying to play as hard out for this organization that gave him a chance. So like, yeah, there's a lot of variability based on individuality there.
When we see situations where, say, like guys get a big contract and then they fall off, right? How do you think that the culture plays into whether people are motivated? Because that seems like a very outcome-based motivation.
Yeah, it's, I mean, I guess it's just like knowing why you're doing the thing. And if it's for money, I mean, we saw this with like Kenny Golladay on the Giants. He cashed out and then did nothing after. And a lot of people cash out and they perform at their best after because they're grateful that they were given the chance.
Like Saquon,
like Jalen Hurts. Jalen Hurts was paid 2 years ago, I think. And he didn't win the Super Bowl until after he was paid. Money can be a motivator. Outcomes can certainly be a motivator, but I just don't believe it's sustainable. I think you have to like have this purpose-based motivation to where you are doing everything you're doing to live in residence, really, as we call it, you know, seeing the dream. What is the dream? To perform at the highest level, competing against the best in the world and like holding my own or, you know, excelling or whatever it might be. And just the feelings that come with that, the achievement and just overall that goal, the money comes alongside it. You find that it's the internal, the intrinsic motivators are much more conducive to sustainable motivation. Whereas maybe there's people who don't have that idea, they don't have that vision, they don't have that purpose. And once they get, you know, an email or an 8-figure contract, start, I'm done.
So if you want to succeed today in terms of mental toughness, whether it's as an individual or on an organizational level, you need to be able to oscillate between that more authoritarian style and also engaging with your people in a way that ties in their individual purpose with the collective. The days of ordering people around and telling them to do things for your sake are long gone. People want to feel like they have an incentive, that they have some skin in the game in terms of their own personal growth. And while that transition does take an investment in your people, probably the help of some mental performance coaches, I think it pays off. And you see like a culture like the Chiefs, who are very much player first and all about individuality and expression.
Yep.
That appears to be in a new way.
So yeah, that's your answer to what's the difference between mental toughness and emotional suppression. We have at least stuck at 10 minutes or some amount.
Both on an individual and collective level.
First. Question two.
All right. So this is a nice segue because we just spoke a little bit about kind of harshness in general. Ordering people around, telling them what to do, holding a carrot on a stick, you know, almost using like scarcity mindset to drive people. For people who have a harsh inner critic, how do they quell that? How do they deal with that? What are the best ways to talk to yourself that can keep you motivated without undermining your progress?
Yeah. So the first thing that's important to think about here is why the inner critic is there, or more generally, why the voice in your head is there. We've alluded to this on several episodes. It's to keep you safe. You know, this voice in your head, this automatic nagging voice, has evolved through evolution, really, to keep us safe, to protect us from threat. As I've said before, we don't live amongst these same threats, but we're still in this neuroceptive mindset to where we're scanning for a threat and we're always telling ourselves, avoid, avoid, avoid. If you had a harsh inner critic, like let's give an example to it. Let's say you just make a game-defining mistake. The game before the game that you're in now. So let's say you were a pitcher in baseball and somebody hits like a grand slam on you and they win the game. Maybe your harsh inner critic in the next game is like yelling, you know, don't be stupid. Don't do this. Don't do that. Like, you know, you're not even good enough to throw against these guys. It is to protect you from the feeling that came with the like impactful moment. Because you do not want to feel that way again. So the brain knows that you don't want to feel that way again without even you telling it. So it kind of tries to like yell at you, be harsh, like a harsh inner critic to steer you away from those feelings again. Once you understand that that's what the harsh inner critic is trying to do, that's what the voice in your head is trying to do, you can learn to again challenge these thoughts. Become your own like inner critic. Become the sort of one who talks to yourself, not the one who listens to yourself, if you will. And if we think about like, performance psychology strategies to address this, name it. Make it a separate entity. Like, hey, this is the judge talking. This is the harsh inner critic talking. And be able to challenge that by a way to kind of emotionally diffuse or cognitively diffuse from the harsh inner criticism is by thinking, what would I tell like my best friend, my favorite teammate, or a family member if they were going through the same thing? If they were saying same things to themselves, what would I tell them? A lot of times we find that we're a lot better at giving advice to others than we are ourselves. And that is because of this emotional detachment. If we don't have any emotional investment in the situation, it's a lot easier to be clear-headed and composed and rational about decision-making.
So it sounds like when it comes to having a harsh inner critic, you need to ask yourself, would I talk to my best friend this way? And the answer is almost certainly no. Better yet, would you have any friends if you talked to them the way that you talk to yourselves? And
Right, huh?
yeah, so when you're in those hard moments, you need the voice that's most influential on you to be the most helpful. And you do have control over that. It's just about becoming aware of your patterns and how you tend to talk to yourself when things get hard. What most people don't understand about having a harsh inner critic is that you have learned to associate harshness with productivity. And there are some times where you need to say to yourself, Logan, I need you to push. I need you to work harder. But asking yourself to do something is different than berating yourself for not doing it. And that's the difference between having a harsh inner critic and productive self-talk. The other side of this issue, when you have a harsh inner critic, is like you mentioned, you put yourself more in fight or flight. And in this part of your nervous system, you're way less cognitively capable to see the situation clearly. And you're in a state where neuroplasticity is less, if not at all, available, which basically means the edit mode of your brain is turned off. So you're trying to make changes by driving yourself further into a state where your body doesn't let you make changes. If you really want to change something, the same thing that you're being harsh about, you need to accept with kindness to yourself so that you can create a foundation, a part of your nervous system where you can actually rewire those patterns.
Yeah, absolutely. And I don't know. I just had this thought. If you don't know what neuroplasticity is by chance, this is like the generation of new nerve pathways. And this is how learning happens. This is how like adaptation, learning new skills, and kind of just development happens. When we're in a state of fight or flight, we're in the state of like get to safety. It's harder to do that. So yeah, just in case anybody didn't know that word.
Speaking of positive voices and talking to yourself in the right way,
Pitch.
this is a good question. Who is somebody not in your field that inspires your mindset?
Okay, I have two answers to this. One is like 25 to 30% in my field because he's an athlete, but he's not in psychology by any means. That's Lamar Jackson, the quarterback at the Baltimore Ravens. There's a lot of reasons to admire Lamar. One, he's a Broward County boy, South Florida, where we said Boynton Beach. He's actually from Pompano. He played at Boynton, but he lived with his Boynton's actually in West Palm or in Palm County, Palm Beach County, excuse me. But anyway, not that matters. I just think his attitude and his mindset is something to be really, really commended. If you followed Lamar's career, there's the whole draft him as a running back. He's a running back. Whether that was play style or racial connotations, either way, it's completely wrong. I mean, you see that now. And I think Lamar had every right to spats on these people. I mean, he's a good quarterback, clearly. He's won the MVP twice, so be honest. And I wish he was my quarterback. But, you're a shade. But he kept his head down and worked. That's what he said he would do. So, you know, I'm going to prove him. I'm going to keep my head down. I know I'm a good quarterback. He came out, I think, his second season after all that that narrative was present. And he threw 158.3 passer rating, which is perfect against the Miami Dolphins in Miami. Not a great thing for a South Florida boy to see. But in the press conference or in the locker room when they were filming him, they told him he had a perfect quarterback rating. He does like a running back juke move. And he's saying like, F you. The people that like said I was just running back. He's just like, he knows what he can do. He's confident. He doesn't need to be too brash about it. And he just gets it done. He's also like done very good things to his community in South Florida, like kind of less fortunate areas. So just a guy I respect a lot there.
Good example of mental toughness too. Speaking of guys who have something to prove and yet they don't make it their whole personality, right? I mean, just cool, calm, and collected, knew what he could do. Didn't want to tell him, he just wanted to show him.
Yeah. A non-sport or performance psychology related answer. It's comedian Theo Bott. And again, a lot of reasons to admire Theo. He's hilarious. He seems kind, good person. But really what he's done in terms of being vulnerable and authentic, especially to like what his base audience presumably is. He's, you know, a man's man, kind of. He's a masculine guy. But he's so open about his mental health struggles. He's so open about like struggling with self-worth, self-doubt, and just not feeling like enough. And the way he speaks about it with the candor and the humor and just the authenticity, I think has helped a lot of people tell to me. And understand that, like, I can ask for help. And this is something Theo and I have in common. I've often viewed, you know, asking for help, especially the early part of my life, as being weak, you know, as asking or admitting weakness. And you find that, you know, we are built to build Rome by ourselves, Rome one day by ourselves, whatever that is. But, like, I just think it's personally impacted me a lot to where, like, I'm a lot more vulnerable, a lot more willing and open to understand that I have issues and like I need help with some of them. And I think like the more that that spreads, especially in the most young men where it is especially hard to admit it. And I mean, I was older men, older generations, but I just think that's such a positive impact. And I really, really commend him for that. He's also just hilarious.
These days, there's so much talk about toxic masculinity. And I think there's some confusion on what that means. A lot of people have taken it to mean that masculinity itself is toxic, and that's not what it is. It's a type of masculinity which is focused on hyper-masculinity or always proving yourself and associating really strongly with the things that we've been told are indicative of being a man, which are completely opposite of being a man. The truth is, being a man means being somebody that is strong and provides for the people around them and leads. And in order to be a good leader, it's a lot more about your actions and leading by example than it is flexing or showing people what you have. Theo has single-handedly helped tens of thousands of young men who now more than ever, millions now more than ever need it, realize that in order to be the best leader you can, in order to be a real man, you have to embrace your struggles. And we see this in the space of psychology too. A lot of people are really tired of talking to their therapist, and their therapist just kind of seeming like this blank wall who has the answers and doesn't have any problems themselves. The truth is, right, we're humans. We deal with things too. And we deal with them in a way that we hope sets an example for our clients and for our community. And we deal with them in a way that the negative things that happen to us make us stronger. And so if you don't show the bad parts of yourself, you're basically admitting that you're avoiding them because you don't know how to use them. When you embrace your flaws and your struggles, you are showing that you find the value when things get hard. And that's what we need every leader, every father, every manager, every CEO, every team captain to do. When things get hard, they're the one that you look to to figure out how to handle this with grace and composure.
It's a perfect full circle back to the mental toughness and emotional suppression question, actually. Is like, that's kind of what I was trying to allude to, and you put good words to it. And like, really what's tough is embracing the things that are holding you back, embracing your issues and accepting that they're there so that you can then move forward. And I often say, without acceptance, there's no path forward. You know, like, if you were in, you have to accept where you're at to get to where you want to go, I guess is what I'm trying to say. Let's give a map-based example. If you're in Denver and you want to go to LA, it's not going to help to think that you're in Bozeman, Montana. You're going to have a complete different roadmap, and you're going to think, I'm at this stage, but really you're not. You're in Denver, and you have to accept that, and you have to get on Saturday, and even though it sucks, then that's just what you got to do. And I think that that is mental toughness, not choosing parade highways, but accepting where you're at and, you know, having the grit to move forward and work on it.
So if you want the mental toughness to have grit when things happen that you don't like, that you don't want to accept, you need to be aware of how you're avoiding those negatives. And then you need to be able to influence your thoughts, feelings, and actions in a way that uses it and channels it instead of suppressing it. And that perfectly aligns with the North Star Method, where the entire point is that we are teaching people to have more awareness so they can say, I noticed that I don't like where I am right now. I noticed that I'm really harsh with myself about it, and I blame myself for it, and I have feelings of guilt and shame. And as long as I dwell in that state, I am essentially blinding myself to the map that I need in order to get out of it. Some of you people are stuck beating themselves up, thinking they're going to crack the whip hard enough and one day they're going to have clarity, and that's never going to come. The truth is, acceptance is the gateway to change, and you have to do it with a gentleness and a warmth that helps you color that map in so that you can channel all that aggression that you had not into yelling at yourself, but it's a pushing yourself to take the right next step.
Well said.
Speaking of, yeah, people not in our field who inspire our mindsets. There is over a couple of receivers down in Tampa Bay that I need to give a shout out to. I want to start with a guy named Chris Goblin, who
Dog.
Is, as of last year before he got injured, was holding the triple crown in receiving stats in the National Football League. This is a player who plays a position that is traditionally seen as one with a lot of divas. And yet, despite the success he's had and the lack of recognition that he's gotten, he's never held that against anybody. He's also faced tremendous adversity, two major injuries now, and arguably came back from his first injury stronger than how he left the field. So most of the time when athletes get injured or when we face any setbacks in our lives, we expect ourselves to come back better, but the reality is we don't. Most people come back worse. And in order to go into such a long recovery, like with an ACL, you have to have a mindset of acceptance, of mental toughness, of grit that is extremely rare. I guarantee you that this next season, when he comes back, a lot of people are going to expect him to be worse. And I would project that his production is going to be exactly the same as it was, even if it takes him some time to ramp up. So Chris Goblin, humble, hard worker, really exemplary of what you want a guy on your team to look like. And
sir, do you know what his last injury was? I know you had that ACL.
In an ACL, and I was dealing with I believe he broke the ankle. Yeah.
That's actually better, I think.
Yeah.
Your broken value is better than ligaments, I think, for receivers.
Yeah. But still.
None matters at all.
Right. I mean, he still was on the stretcher. And as they took him off the field in the stretcher, he looks at the trainer and you see him.
Back to work,
right? Immediately refocus. And in his presser when he was re-signed, all he was talking about was gratitude. Yeah. Like, the fact this organization believes in me, my wife and my family and the fans. So his mindset is clearly rooted in gratitude. I think what's important too is he has a life away from football. I know he's into photography. So this is a high performer who has discipline, not just to absolutely maximize his productivity within football, but also to have a leg outside of it so that he can rest, recover,
restore, yeah,
and come back and put everything he has into that recovery. Watch out for Chris Godwin this year, because he's going to be underrated once again, and he's going to prove him wrong once again.
Fantasy sleeper. And one thing, more thing about Godwin that I haven't seen him say, but I imagine, because, I mean, injury recovery, why I got into this, and understanding that, like, he probably knows that great things take time. He didn't build his career in a couple of years, or in a year, or whatever it might be. He played football since he was a kid, and worked at it his whole life, through high school, through college, and got through point where he's at, and he's recovered from several injuries at this point. At some point, you understand that things take time, and, you know, a lot of people who maybe hadn't been through as much adversity might have been more rapid. Might have been like, shit, I tore my ACL, am I ever coming back? I broke my ankle, am I ever going to come back to full strength? And they might not have the fortitude or the mental resilience to actually overcome it. And I think that Godwin's experience, as well as like many other, you know, athletes in the NFL and other leagues there, goes in fat, like, big picture kind of high. We gotta do Goodell for 9 months or so here.
Yeah, I think, you know, with a lot of receivers in the NFL now more than ever, it's not hard to find guys, you know, with hands or can run. The Bucs continue to invest in people and believe in them when other people would not. And even after his injury, it was reported that Godwin had an opportunity to go to New England or some unnamed team for apparently $30 million more than what the Buccaneers gave him. So that goes back to our question about mental toughness on a collective level and having a culture where you support your people. I would argue, and, you know, I wasn't there, but if I was on the Patriots in 2013 and somebody else offered me $30 million more to go be the number one receiver on the team, you know, in warm weather with no income tax, I might take it. So you need to reinvest in your people and look at them as something to build up and not something to just throw away. When you do that, you get a number two receiver who is a number one receiver caliber player, and he's going to take a $30 million discount because he values where he lives. These are humans, and if you treat them like that, I mean, crazy to say, you're going to get results. Speaking of humans, not a great segue, very broad.
Yeah, but I was always thinking about this as well, and, you know, you're more of the guy on this side of things, so I wanted to ask you. With AI everywhere, obviously, this is the age of artificial intelligence. No one's really talking about it, or, you know, psychology or mental performance. And if they are, they're just not loud enough. So I'm just kind of wondering, what purpose can AI serve as a mental performance coach, for example? How could these kind of fields be intertwined?
So obviously ChatGPT exists, and you or somebody you know has already tried to use it as a therapist. Does it work? Is it something that you should do? Let's go back to 2015 when Facebook integrated a CBT chatbot into Facebook Messenger, which reportedly was very widely used. CBT is kind of an outdated form of psychology. We've built on it since then. There are still some good things in it.
Certainly.
But the point is, it's not even the most effective thing that we have, and yet it seemed to help a lot of people, and that wasn't even a large language model. That was just a chatbot. And so that is to say that it was exponentially less effective than what we have today, and yet people still wanted to use it. Why would you want to use AI as your therapist? Well, for one, they're definitely not going to judge you. Second, it's probably a lot cheaper. And third, nobody's really going to know what problems you have. And in a world where we have this big stigma around working on the mind, there are a lot of people with a lot of problems that will prefer to not tell another human. We believe that the stigma in psychology is built into the way we do the work. I don't think we're going to get around it or improve it any more than we already have. I think that the general population has already done a ton of work to talk about their stories and make mental health more palatable for the general public.
Yeah.
But the truth is that the way that education and industry of psychology treats the profession is what's leading to the way that we're thinking about it. In grad school, when you go get a psychology degree, They'll tell you that unless you speak with them about it otherwise, if you notice your client in public, you avert eye contact. Tell me one other profession where you have to pretend to not know your client. Working on your mind should be something that you're proud of. Training your mind should be as popular as training the body. And we believe that mental performance is a way to get people excited about doing just that. Until we proliferate that idea, we're going to continue to see people who want to use AI as their therapist or as their coach. Even when we make it a commonplace thing to train your mind, the truth is, because of how expensive and inaccessible these programs are, there are not enough therapists or coaches, and there probably won't be for a very long time. And so, just like in every other profession, I don't think AI is going to replace practitioners in psychology, but it is absolutely going to augment the work and improve it. Right now, if you go in the App Store and you look up AI therapist, you can find it, and it might help you with a couple of issues that you're facing. But it's probably going to have a price tag on it that's not worth paying. And eventually, it's going to say something that is going to make you realize that you wish you were talking to a person. That's because people who are not in psychology are building these things. If we can download all of the wisdom and insight from hundreds of years of psychological science, if we can get the same tools and skills that the best ones have and put it into AI, then it's going to be really helpful for when, say, it's 3 a.m. and you can't reach your coach. And that's why within the North Star app, which we are working on very hard and is coming sooner than later, we are going to have an AI mental performance coach that you can talk to 24/7. And it's going to be able to keep track of the work that you are doing with your human coach so that it can sort of supplement it in between sessions. Because just like with physical training, if you go to the gym and then you don't sleep and you don't eat, you're not going to get better. And so AI is going to help you make the most of your time outside of the session so that you can reap all the benefits of mental performance training, even when you don't have access to your coach.
Yeah, I guess you mentioned like there's not enough coaches, there's not enough therapists for everybody. Yeah, the truth is coaching is just like not very scalable. And if everybody like wants access to enhancing their mind and training their mind, which they deserve, it should, I think that the North Star app is a kind of great place to start once it is launched. You know, accessibility to, you know, content, to these resources that are actually going to give you more than just a chatbot. You know, I think it's a perfect sort of segue, or I guess balance, I should say segue, a perfect balance between AI and like human coaching. And one more thing about coaching, thing you mentioned, like the palatability and the stigma around psychology. I think that's kind of where mental performance coaching, and especially we come in, is like our clients are crowdwork with us. Our client yesterday posted us on a story. And like when I see clients, I haven't really like come across them that much, I guess, outside of working in sessions, but I have a couple times. They're always like, yo, what's up? Like, yeah, it's a coach. You're proud of your strength coach a lot of times, your head coach, your receivers coach, your nutritionist. Like, these are not things you hide. And they're arguably less integral to our performance and well-being than the mind. So it just goes to show, like, AI does have a role, that we also have a role in trying to chip away the stigma as much as we can without wasting our energy.
One more point to add on to what AI can do for you in terms of improving your mental performance. There are always situations that you get into where you need your exercises customized to you. So right now, you're downloading Headspace, you're downloading Calm, you're going on YouTube, looking up binaural beats. That same thing that you're watching, a million other people have used. When you make something for everybody, you made it for nobody. The truth is that we need customized mental performance exercises, customized meditations, visualizations, binaural beats that are built for you, the language that you speak, the sport that you play, the goals that you have. And AI is going to allow us to customize your mental skills training to you in a way that not only makes it more effective, but just makes it more fun. And so we envision a world where you talk with your mental performance coach about your upcoming competition. You develop a mental performance routine where you're doing breathing exercises and meditations and listening to binaural beats. And then you go into your AI performance coach that builds these custom exercises for you. If this sounds interesting to you, we will be releasing a waitlist for the app. We would like to test it with a small group of beta users. And so if you think that you're somebody who can give good feedback on an app like this, we'll put it out on social media, but you could go to NorthstarNose/beta, NorthstarNose.com/beta, and sign up, apply to get early access to the Northstar app. So by now, it should be abundantly clear that when it comes to mental toughness, it's not about suppressing your emotions. It's about feeling it all without getting lost in it. Also, when you build a culture, whether it's within a team, within a business, or within a family, you want to encourage people to feel all the hard stuff and relate to it in a way that is productive and useful, not avoid it. We want you to realize as well that motivation is not about proving everybody else wrong as much as it is about proving yourself right. And that the people who are the best performers and the most confident in themselves, they don't say things, they show people. Lastly, we do believe that technology is going to revolutionize the way that we implement psychology. We are sick and tired of the stigma around working on your mind, and we envision a world where everybody is proud to train their mind the same way they train their body. The Northstar app is going to be a huge component of that, and we'd love to have you be a part of it.
And the theme of a mind, the part of the body that encloses the mind is the head. And on heads, you wear hats.
What? I mean, like, that's segue. That's segue. And but if you like the hat that I'm wearing, or the black hat that Sebastian usually wears that he forgot in his car, or the Spoy hat that's also the one that I'm wearing sitting right in front of the camera here, these are soon to be available. Oh, there you go. These are soon to be available on the Northstar website, customized from 1010 Hats down in Florida. Shout out 1010 Hats. They're amazing, all your custom hat needs. But yeah, they'll soon to be available on NorthstarNose.com as well.
Yep, you can check out NorthstarNose.com/shop for the hats, but also for future merch releases. And I also want to say that while we want you to just support the brand and we appreciate you repping the Northstar, this is also just a really good quality hat. It's waterproof, so like I've brought it in the washer multiple times, something that you can't do with most hats.
Yeah.
You can wear it for workouts. You can also kind of dress it up. I've worn it to conferences with like business, not business casual, whatever step above that is.
Yeah, I wear it every day no matter what.
Yeah, exactly. So I kind of feel naked without it.
I feel completely mentally off when I'm not.
You also use it as a cue to remember to practice your mental skills. So
Yeah. Always looking at it.
NorthstarNose.com/shop coming very soon so that you can get yourself a Northstar hat. With that being said, as always, we very much appreciate your support. And if you would like to demonstrate that support in a no-cost way to you, you can like and subscribe to this video on YouTube, Apple, Spotify, and we're now on Amazon Podcasts as well. New episodes weekly, clips on @NorthstarMethod. And do us a favor, if you got anything out of this episode, tell your friend who needs to be a little bit more mentally tough. You know who we're talking about.
Oh, yeah.
They always got their chest puffed out. You know, they're a little too... Just send them this episode. Help them out.
With that, love y'all. Go Gators. Peace.
See you next week.